Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From the Washington Post staff writers Brady Dennis and Renee Merle, Democrats push more mortgage aid. TARP would provide funds, and the House is to vote on financial regulation. House Democrats are seeking to tap the government's massive bailout fund to help homeowners who have lost their jobs and are struggling to make their mortgage payments. House Financial Services Committee Chairman Barney Frank, Democrat from Massachusetts, last week signed on to a proposal by Representative Maxine Waters, a Democrat from California, that would channel $3 billion from the Federal Troubled Assets Relief Program toward mortgage relief for jobless Americans. The measure would designate another $1 billion for a program that gives grants to state and local governments to purchase foreclosed properties and use them for more productive purposes. The combination of unemployment and foreclosures may be the greatest threat to our economic recovery, Waters said. The proposal is one of more than 100 proposed amendments to a sweeping financial regulatory reform package scheduled for consideration in the full House. In addition, Democratic lawmakers are planning to use the regulatory reform bill to revive a provision that would allow bankruptcy judges to modify a homeowner's mortgage, including lowering the interest rate or cutting the principal owed. The provision passed the House earlier this year, but is fiercely opposed by the financial services industry and was voted down in the Senate. The renewed efforts came in the wake of recent complaints by the Congressional Black Caucus about the Obama administration's handling of the economy. Caucus members, alarmed by the particularly harsh toll that foreclosures and unemployment have wrought on minority communities, have pushed in recent weeks to provide more tangible help to ailing homeowners. The caucus has held numerous meetings with White House officials and delayed a vote on the regulatory reform bill to draw attention to its concerns. The Obama administration's foreclosure prevention program, known as Making Home Affordable, has faced pressure recently because lenders have moved only a small percentage of borrowers from the initial trial phase to a permanent loan modification. Data to be released by the Treasury Department this week will show that about 6% of borrowers enrolled in the program so far have moved from trial modification to permanent adjustment, according to two industry officials. Treasury officials called a meeting with the industry leaders on the issue last week as part of a campaign to address the challenges borrowers face in receiving permanent modifications, Michael S. Barr, a Treasury Assistant Secretary, said in a statement. Mortgage servicers are on notice that they must ramp up and provide sustained relief to struggling homeowners now, he said. Industry officials say the small percentage reflects hundreds of thousands of borrowers who have not provided enough documentation to prove they are eligible for the program. But housing advocates argue that many homeowners remain in limbo even after submitting documents multiple times. Treasury is scheduled to release detailed data showing which lenders have completed the greatest number of modifications. Mortgage industry officials
meanwhile, are less than thrilled that the so-called cram-down provision, which would allow judges to modify loans in bankruptcy, might get a second chance in Congress. We continue to think it's a bad idea, especially given the market of uncertainty the country is in, said Steve O'Connor, a senior vice president of the Mortgage Bankers Association. The measures proposed by Frank Waters and others would become part of a wide-ranging bill to overhaul the nation's fractured financial regulatory structure. Frank's committee in recent months has approved a series of measures, including bills to establish oversight of the vast derivatives market and create an agency to regulate credit cards, mortgages, and other consumer loans. The bills, which pass separately through the committee, will be bundled into one piece of legislation for consideration in the full House. Debate on the inclusive bill is scheduled to begin during the week with a final vote by this week's end. In a continuing analysis by NewYorkDailyNews.com, homewreckers, the $75 billion federal plan to ward off foreclosures isn't doing the job. The U.S. government and America's biggest banks speedily executed a $250 billion bailout last winter while promising to do something for homeowners threatened with foreclosures. Promises, promises. 10 months later, the $75 billion Making Home Affordable program is a bust. It was supposed to rescue 3 million to 4 million qualified homeowners by lowering mortgage interest rates, but as yet, only 651,000 loans are in the pipeline, and only 2,000 or so have been converted to permanent lower-rate mortgages. This is a travesty across the country and in New York City. While foreclosures have slowed in the five boroughs in 2009, banks have filed 35,257 cases since 2007, and some neighborhoods are being devastated. For example, as detailed by the Daily News, Southeast Queens is the epicenter of boarded-up houses and unkempt yards. In one four-square block area, 98 homes were in foreclosure in June 2008. Last month, there were 27 more. Meanwhile, unscrupulous chiselers are acquiring homes for pennies on the dollar, using phony buyers to jack up prices, snagging mortgages that are far larger than the house's real value, and abandoning the houses again. Oh, and walking away with the cash. The Federal Mortgage Relief Program cannot help everyone or save every house. It was touted as aiding those homeowners who have a good shot, with a little help, of keeping their houses. Still, it's falling way short. There are clear signs that some banks have dodged their responsibility to work with homeowners. The Treasury Department plans to shame these institutions into cooperating. Can't hurt. At the same time, it is also evident that thousands of homeowners have failed to file the paperwork required to modify loans. While Treasury officials are busy castigating the banks, they also need to find out why so many property owners are laggard and redesign the program to get things moving and fast. So again, that was from the NewYorkDailyNews.com. And finally this week, the FDIC closed six more banks, with the largest AM Trust Bank estimated to cost the Deposit Insurance Fund, DIF, $2 billion. That brings the total FDIC bank failures to 130 in 2009. While the closure is not surprising, given the parent company's bankruptcy filing this week, and this is regarding AM Trust Bank, it is still stunning to the bank's 280,000 local customers, 1,400 local employees, and a community that had watched the sleepy thrift become a national powerhouse and an important philanthropic force across Northeast Ohio. While depositors aren't losing anything, the FDIC fund is taking an estimated $2 billion hit, according to FDIC spokesman David Barr. The FDIC entered into an agreement to cap New York Community Bank's potential losses on the loans it's buying. NYCB agreed to buy about $9 billion in AM Trust assets. The FDIC will keep the remaining $3 billion in loans to sell later. Among the nation's 8,100 banks, AmTrust was the 92nd largest as of June 30th. At its height, it was the 68th largest in 2006 and 2007. In the last 2 years, it lost nearly 40% of its assets and deposits as its loans lost value, CDs matured, and customers left. AmTrust was simply into mortgage lending too deep, much of it risky or in markets that were about to implode. As a side note, bank failures seem to come in bunches, and with 3 weeks to go in this year, it seems 140-plus bank failures are likely this year. And finally, the cumulative estimated losses for the deposit insurance fund since early 2007 is now over $52.4 billion. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, in the second segment of the show, we'll be discussing the two-income trap, which we've been doing for some weeks now, which is why middle-class mothers and fathers are going broke, and some surprising solutions that will change our children's future. This is a book by Elizabeth Warren and her daughter, Amelia Warren Tyagi, and is essentially the textbook for the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program. In the last several weeks, I've been talking about school, public education, and how that has impacted on the cost of homes in the middle class. Last week, in particular, I discussed parts of education that could be helped using a voucher system. So people could be choosing schools rather than being forced to move to the location of the school they want to go to, and can also have an impact on the quality of the school. This would save people a fair amount of money in terms of kindergarten through 12th grade education, and would definitely save people a lot of money in terms of the bidding wars that take place in areas that have the best schools on homes. Professor Warren and Amelia have gotten tremendous data showing how the costs of homes in those school districts have escalated due to the middle class desire to get their kids in those schools. Also, last week I discussed the other sides of kindergarten and 12th grade. Started out looking at preschool and how that is not a publicly funded opportunity for children, and yet experts are generally pointing to the fact that kids do belong in preschool if they're going to be more highly prepared and developed for the traditional education K through 12, and yet how this costs so much money for families. This has become an extraordinarily competitive area for parents trying to get their kids into school in the top-ranked preschools, which have, frankly, limited slots. Again, the concept is that the experts say your kid belongs in school. This just is not a daycare consideration. The bottom line is the impact on middle-class families' wallets is tremendous. So something has to be done to include this kind of schooling in public education. As I said, as it exists now, a full-day program in pre-kindergarten offered by, for example, Chicago Public School District costs the parents over $7,000 a year, which is more than the cost of a year's tuition at the University of Illinois. And yet, parents put their kids on the waiting list for the few slots in these kinds of programs. As I also mentioned, according to one study, the annual cost for a four-year-old to attend such a program in an urban area is more than double the price of college tuition in 15 states. Today's middle-class families are spending and spending, really stretching their budgets to give their child the fundamentals of a modern education on the introductory side of education. And the solution is fairly obvious. You have to extend the scope of public education that is not just in the public building, but paid for by the public. Americans generally believe that educational programs should begin at age 3, so public education should not wait to kick in at age 5 or 6.
As I pointed out, the decision about how old children should be when they start school was made more than a century ago, when the views about the learning capacity of young children were very different. So the absence of publicly funded preschool is an anachronism, one that could easily be remedied. And lots of politicians actually have supported this idea of publicly funded universal preschool. It just needs to be brought up once again in a formal way to make this funded.
So that was the preschool side of the education. But what about the college side, where people are paying tremendous amount of money for their children and the middle class is suffering? So the other end of the education spectrum has American parents advised to start stashing away money before the little ones can even walk. Professor Warren points out some very funny facts. Americans tend to disagree on basic facts of history. So, for example, in a poll, 6% of fellow Americans believe that the Apollo moon landings were faked. Yet, on the other hand, there is one topic on which Americans overwhelmingly agree, and that is the importance of a college education. According to a very recent survey, 97% of Americans agree that a college degree is absolutely necessary or helpful, compared with a scant 3% claiming that a degree is not that important. In other words, Americans are twice as likely to believe that man never walked on the moon as they are to believe that a college degree doesn't matter. In our diverse culture full of contrarians who really relish our differences with one another, faith in the power of higher education is in a way a new secular religion. Americans now see a college degree as the single most important determinant of a young person's chances of success, even more significant than getting along well with others or having a good work ethic. And as I pointed out a generation ago, not everyone in the family was expected to go to college. I was from a family of 3 children, and I was the only one that went to college. And the other 2 siblings were skilled tradespeople. And I suspect this is typical for many people a generation or 2 ago. Education was valued, but no one would have claimed that it was the single most important determinant of a young person's success. Today, 77% of adults say that getting a college education is more important than it was just 10 years ago, and 87% believe that a college education has become as important as a high school diploma used to be. Middle-class parents obeying the dictate, essentially, that college is central in the new economy, have found themselves to be combatants in yet another active bidding war. Once again, supply and demand are out of balance. The number of students aiming for a spot in a decent 4-year institution is rising every year, while the number of openings at the major public and private universities stay essentially the same. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And now I'm talking about the cost to middle-class families for a college education, particularly in light of the essential desire that our children go to college to be successful in our economy. What has occurred is essentially another active bidding war. We talked about it with respect to houses. Now we're talking about it with respect to college education. The number of students competing for spots in 4-year institutions is rising, yet the number of openings stays the same. And this is true not just at the Ivy League kinds of schools, but also at the big state universities. There used to be the open admission policy that once ensured pretty much everyone a slot at State U, but this has virtually disappeared. In fact, many state universities no longer have room even for average students, let alone struggling ones. A primary example that Professor Warren and Amelia give is the University of Wisconsin, which announced that the majority of its student body graduated in the top 10% of their high school classes. Well, not everyone can be in the top 10%, and parents find themselves in a bind. For the growing number of parents whose kids don't make it into the local public university, there may be little choice but to come up with $25,000, $30,000, $35,000 a year for tuition, room, and board at a private college, according to the cost data. Now, with more applications flooding admissions offices every year, colleges are really taking advantage of the demand. They have been free to increase the price of admission with relative impunity. Parents may complain and students may protest, as we just saw recently in California when the tuition was raised. But since nearly two-thirds of parents view a degree for their child as an absolute essential, universities can safely assume that families will find a way to pay. And this is precisely what has happened. After adjusting for inflation, in-state tuition and fees at the average state university have nearly doubled in less than 25 years. To put that in perspective, the price of college has grown twice as fast as the average professor's salary, three times faster than the cost of food, and eight times faster than the cost of electricity. But tuition, room, and board now cost more than $8,600 a year at the average public university. When we look at this, to pay these kinds of fees, the average family in the United States, middle class, would have to commit 17% of its total pre-tax income to this one expense. And private education is even more prohibitive. And then there's also a glitch. Some families make enough that disqualifies them for financial aid, but not enough to pay for the college education. Many families are out at least $100,000 at the end of their child's education, and that's only one child. It really is no surprise, then, that 6 out of 10 Americans also believe it is absolutely essential that university administrators keep tuition from rising, but really, despite the public opinion, costs continue to spiral upward. University officials typically blame tuition hikes on the inevitable consequences of rising costs. They point to the high cost of keeping up with scientific discoveries, the need to provide technology resources for students and faculty, and the growth in financial aid, all valuable endeavors. This has been summed up by the economist David Brenneman, who claimed, "There is no problem for the federal government or colleges and universities to solve other than the public relations task of explaining the economic facts of life to the populace." Professor Warren contradicts this. She says that not all the costs increases are just facts of life, as Dr. Brenneman suggests. She points out that the American Association of University Professors blames spiraling administrative costs, which grew by 60% between 1980 and 1987, to be the basis for the problem. Also, the American Council of Education points to student expectations for a high level and wide variety of services, which includes, among other things, better food services. Another study shows that the more prestigious colleges have decreased the teaching loads of their undergraduate professors, giving them more time for research and other pursuits. And as we all know, then there are sports. In winning years, a few of the biggest programs only break even if they had sellout crowds and television deals. Yet, For most colleges, the cost to field teams in every sport from football to water polo must come out of the general budget. One example is basketball powerhouse Duke University. Every year, it takes $4 million to $5 million out of the university's general revenues to pump into the athletic budget. A school like Columbia University in New York allocates even more, redirecting $7 million a year of its general revenue to make up the shortfall in athletics. As Professor Warren points out, in the race to win the most games, universities are spending more every year and the deficits are getting larger. According to the National Collegiate Athletic Association, the overwhelming majority of colleges lose money on their sports programs. During the 1990s, the average deficit grew by more than 50% for all but the largest universities. Now, I point out these expenditures not because I am a Scrooge when it comes to sports, just the opposite, having been an athlete in college myself. There are obviously some very good and important benefits to the athletes and the fans when it comes to sports. But there is a myth here. The myth that college costs are like helium balloons that inevitably rise by the immutable laws of nature. Colleges are charging more, not because they must, but because they can. Like parents, the institutions of higher learning have entered into a bidding war of their own. Not the war to provide the best value to families, but the war to produce the best research, win the most basketball games, and serve the best food. According to the Chronicle of Higher Education, virtually every university in America aspires to make it into the top 50 or top 20 or top 10%. As a result, colleges have engaged in an arms race of expenditures triggered by the pursuit of prestige, and parents are stuck paying the bill. In the absence of rising demand, this arms race of prestige just wouldn't have been possible. If Americans had not come to view a college degree as equivalent to an admission ticket to good jobs and middle-class lifestyle, then the demand for a university slot would have been much less intense. As a result, parents would have been much freer to shop for a college on the basis of price or to forego higher education altogether if the price seemed too high. All but the most elite universities would have felt far more pressure to keep costs down. Colleges might have been forced to make some painful cuts, but university tuition would have behaved more like any other rational marketplace in which supply and demand are balanced and price holds relatively steady. So what about a tuition freeze? It's an interesting point that whenever the problem of college costs are discussed, conservative policymakers typically focus on making more loans available to families. Being a bankruptcy attorney and knowing the reality of student loans, I can tell you conclusively this is not really a solution. For example, in 2001, over 5 million students had borrowed $34 billion in federal student loans, more than triple the amount borrowed just 10 years earlier. And those are federal student loans. What's happening now, which we'll get into, is now there are private student loans with adjustable interest rates that are not very good bargains. Students borrowing from private lenders, in fact, have grown even faster, increasing fivefold in just the 6 years before 2001, and this has grown even more in the last decade. And it's not just the college students that bear the burden. Parents are going deep into debt to pay for their children's education. Every year, more than 1 million families take out a second mortgage on their homes just to pay for educational expenses. And I will continue next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, Voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.